I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Well, thanks, Ken. I enjoy our time together.
Several weeks ago, you began explaining some of the more obscure terms used in commercial property transactions. You know, there have been two terms I always seem to get confused, and they are joint tenants and tenants in common. I realise they have nothing to do with leases, but would you mind just clarifying the difference between the two?
Well, Ken, I'm not at all surprised that you're confused. I mean, it took me a number of years to fully understand and be able to remember the difference between joint tenants and tenants in common. Now, let me try and keep it as simple as I can, but a joint tenancy is a form of co-ownership in which the following principles apply. Now, in theory, each joint tenant owns the whole property jointly with the other owners, and no party has a specific share of the property while the joint tenancy continues. Now, this means that the joint tenants must have equal interests in the property and are entitled to equally its rents and profits. And there can obviously be more than just two joint tenants. Now, also, the principle of survivorship applies, and on the death of one of the joint tenants, the surviving joint tenants or tenants acquire the whole property automatically by operation of law, and it follows that the property held in joint tenancy does not form part of the estate of the tenant who dies. So a joint tenant cannot, in his or her will, deal with the property held in a joint tenancy. Now, also the principle of joint tenancy applies to real estate as well as property like cars, shares, furniture and bank accounts, but principally it's used for the ownership of property. And also joint tenancy is usual in marriage where the spouse wants to hold or spouses want to hold the property equally and also want the principle of survivorship to apply. However, it's not as common in other situations. Now, if you hold real estate as a joint tenant, you can easily sever the joint tenancy and convert it to being a tenancy in common, which we'll talk about in a moment. And this is something which needs to be seriously considered in many situations, especially where a marriage or de facto relationship has broken down. Now, you've got to be careful that unwittingly, when two people buy the property, that they're not deemed to be buying it as joint tenants, because, as I said, that survivorship rule, it can be quite devastating to the family left of the one that dies, who were under the misapprehension that they would, in fact, receive in the will that part of the property. So a will can't override statutory law, and so you have to be very careful. So that leads us on to tenants in common. Now, again, this is a form of co-ownership in which the property is held in common with others, but where, in contrast to joint tenants, the share of a deceased tenancy forms part of the deceased's estate and passes to his or her beneficiaries under their will or certain prescribed persons if there is no will. Now, tenants in common have fixed undivided shares of the property, and also they can have unequal shares. For example, one might be two-thirds and the other is one-third of the property. And just by way of a quick example, when one of my children were wanting to buy a home, they didn't quite have enough to qualify for a loan. So my super fund bought, as a tenant in common with them, I think it chipped in about 40% of the equity. Now, that was done, the title is then divided as to 60% for my child and 40% for my super fund. Now, it was only intended as a temporary arrangement, but my 40% was bought debt-free through the super fund. However, quite separately, my son was able to borrow against his 60% and fund that. Now, what's important there is that each one, and also the title actually is divided into two. You actually have separate titles issued for the one property. I have a standalone title as to 40%, and he had a standalone title as to 60%, which he could lodge for borrowing. Now, the only proviso, as far as the lender was concerned, was that if, God forbid, that they had to sell the property, I would agree to offer my share at the same time. So the property could be realised to extinguish his debt if push came to shove as far as the financier was concerned. So anyway, that's a practical example of how it's worked in my life. Now, the assets are held as tenants in common, and they do form part of your estate. Now, we never got to that stage in my example because when he got enough money, he actually bought out my share and therefore owned the whole title in his own name. So, as you can see, there are significant differences between the two types of ownerships, and you need to carefully consider which is appropriate to your particular circumstances. So, as I said, most people, you might go into a partnership with someone, but you don't actually need a partnership agreement. You can buy a property and go as tenants in common and have each, assuming it's equal, 50% to one and 50% to another. And those titles and the borrowing on those separate titles can be treated quite independently of the other. So hopefully that gives you a bit of an understanding of what that difference means.
Now let's talk about arrears.
When we talk about arrears in the property sense, you really first think of rent or your mortgage payments. Now generally rent is paid in advance, and therefore the leases provide that there's a grace period of about 7 days after which you are deemed to be in arrears. So it refers to effectively, in generally, an overdue debt, liability or obligation. And it's where you have missed one or more payments that are intended to be occurring regularly. Now, in arrears, though, the term in arrears does not necessarily have a negative connotation, because there are some mortgages where they may be on fixed interest or whatever, and that you actually are required to pay the interest payments at the end of the period. So, and it may be that if you invest in from a bond point of view, if you put your money out on call, generally the interest that you get on your money is paid at the end when it falls due. If you've got a 30, 60, 6 months, whatever, bond or put your money out on call, when the money is returned to you, that's when the interest is paid. So, as I said, you can be in arrears, but sometimes the contract says that the payments are made in arrears, which is not the case with rent, but can be the case with some mortgages and other fixed interest instruments. So just need to be aware of the nuances there.
Maybe you would also like to explain the difference between an easement and a covenant.
Once again, there can be some confusion between easements and covenants. An easement, in essence, is a contractual right recorded on the title that one person has over another person's piece of land. Now, when I say person, it can be a utility such as sewage or electricity, but it means that over a strip of land, that party has access or rights of use. And it generally refers in a driveway where there might be a two-lot subdivision and you need to get to the second title, you need to have access to get over it. Now, sometimes they create what's called battle axe titles, which have effectively the block at the back with a strip down one side for the driveway. But sometimes the simpler way to do it is to simply create a driveway easement or easement of access on the first title to the second title. But quite often there's sewage. There might be, particularly in country properties, an easement for electricity going over. Now, that doesn't mean you can't use the land, but it generally means you can't build on the land, or you can't concrete it in the case of if it's sewage, because if they need to get to the sewage pipe, they don't want to have to come in on private property and start to pull up concrete paths and what have you, or demolish houses or garages and so forth. But it just gives rights of access across the land for the purpose of or the benefit of another party, either external being in the case of a public utility or adjoining in the case of rights of an easement giving rights of access. Now, a covenant, on the other hand, a covenant is a restriction placed on a title. Now, it generally occurs for a subdivision, and particularly in a lot of the new subdivisions that are occurring residentially, it sometimes they have a covenant that you can only plant native trees, or you can only build your property of brick construction, or you can only build a property of single story. Now, they're covenants in place for the benefit of the adjoining residents in that particular subdivision. Now, it's unusual that just one property has a covenant on it, although it is possible for someone to, if they, for whatever reason, want to preserve the nature of the property that they're selling, they can place a covenant on it. The risk they run, though, is that someone who buys the property and believes that the covenant is capricious or overly restrictive can apply to the Supreme Court to have the covenant lifted. If the court holds that the covenant, lifting the covenant, is not going to be detrimental to the adjoining properties, then more often than not, they will do it. It's a messy process, but it is possible to have those sort of covenants removed. But where they apply to a general area or subdivision, mostly they endure. The only thing might be that if over time in some of the inner suburbs around the capital cities, covenants were placed when, you know, way back that it was sort of an outlying area, but now it's inner suburban. It may be because of development and progress that the original covenant is just seen to be superfluous to the well-being of the surrounding area. Then, more often than not, the council will encourage you to go to the Supreme Court. In other words, they won't object and have the covenant lifted so that you can develop the property, if that's what you want to do, to a higher and better use. So again, that hopefully explains the difference between easements and covenants.
Perhaps the last term for today, what does fiduciary mean?
Yeah, fiduciary duty is not something that crops up a lot, but it is an important concept to understand. And in essence, it's a legal obligation that one party has to act in the best interests of another. And the obligated party is typically a fiduciary, that is, someone entrusted with the care of money, property, etc., and that's called a fiduciary obligation. So it's both a noun and an adjective. Now, for example, when I'm buying property for people, I explain to them that if you go to a selling agent, he or she has difficulty in giving you some of the intimate background to the vendor and so forth. Whereas if I go to them as agent to agent, they're likely to divulge, look, you know, if I were you, this is a great opportunity. The vendor has to refinance the property. They're under a bit of pressure. I think we can do a quick deal. Now, if the agent said that to you, he would be breaching his fiduciary responsibility as far as his vendor is concerned. And he couldn't or wouldn't say that to you because he, I mean, some vendors are really tricksy and they send, for want of a better word, mystery shoppers, if you like, to go and inquire of the agent and see what sort of information they're providing to the general public. But as I said, from agent to agent, I'm, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I can't pass that on to you if I'm acting for you. I can use it to your advantage, but that agent would have difficulty and be in breach of that relationship with his client if he were to tell you that direct. In the same way, you know, you have to question sometimes with financial planners, and that's why they're under a lot of stress at the moment, that, you know, they're trying to give you supposedly unbiased financial advice, and yet they're taking commissions from the insurance companies and the people with whom they offer the product. So just it's an interesting concept and something you need to be aware of.
I realise that what we've covered today may not be overly exciting. However, I think it's important for investors to fully understand the various words and phrases being used, given the amount of money involved with the purchases being made.
Yes, look, most of these terms have been handed down through the English legal system over many years. And so if you haven't studied law, you probably wouldn't necessarily come across them.
I wonder if we might now turn to something everyone seems to want to know more about. During the time we've spent together over the past couple of years, you've covered a number of key pointers when it comes to negotiating. But how do you handle it when everything appears to be grinding to a halt and being able to make any further progress seems most unlikely?
Well, I guess you've got to look at things or take steps where sometimes you just need to take a breather. Now, that might sound somewhat trite, but often that's all it needs for you and the other party to gather your thoughts and allow them to save face while subtly changing from an earlier stance that they had in the negotiation. Now, if you know a negotiation will extend over a long period, it's often useful to agree to have hourly breaks at the outset. And that way, you will be able to better stay on top of what your objectives are. Another important thing is to separate out fact from fiction. Now, you need to distinguish the hard facts from some of the fictitious statements being made by verifying the information rather than merely accepting it at face value. Now, you see, dealing in facts is the key to reaching your desired outcome. So evaluate them and determine their relevance, and then just present sound arguments to counter any inaccuracies that you're being given. As well as facts and fiction, you need to identify any grey areas. Now, there may be some areas you can't easily label as fact or fiction. Sometimes you simply lack sufficient information to make the call, and you may need to reconvene at a later date so that you're able to fill in the gaps. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself unable to make clear positions in your argument simply because these particular areas are somewhat fuzzy.
So, while you may have separated out facts from the fiction, I imagine there are times when you find things can become very frustrating.
Look, I can assure you there are many times you get frustrated, and the secret is you've got to keep your anger in check. As much as you might feel justified or goaded or being goaded to do so, threats are unacceptable and disrespectful, and you lose credibility when you do it. So when anger prevents a negotiation from progressing, you need to put this emotion aside. I mean, you'll find by simply introducing a third party quite often, you can completely alter the dynamics of the negotiation and thereby prevent the earlier anger from resurfacing. But understand that anger is generally a reflection of the importance of the issues involved. And sometimes you might need to tackle a fresh issue in order to diffuse the present anger in relation to the current issue.
Apart from introducing a fresh face into the negotiation, what else could you do?
Well, one thing you could do is to try and reach agreement in principle. I mean, sometimes emotions and words tend to get in the way. Either or both of you might be so intent upon getting across a specific point or resolving a minor issue that you momentarily allow yourselves to lose sight of the bigger picture. However, if you can just come to an agreement in principle, then you're both moving forwards with your objectives and you're improving your chances of reaching a mutually satisfying outcome. You see, all you need do is to change your approach without actually altering your intent.
I imagine there are times when one or both parties in a negotiation can become sidetracked. What is the best way to handle that?
Yeah, look, this can happen particularly if you're having to negotiate over an extended period of time, or you might be, there's a difference between sometimes a property negotiation where you're going back and forth, and it stretches over a few days. But if you find you're in a room having to nut out those last few things, and sometimes I find if you do reach an impasse with a vendor, quite often I'll say to the agent, look, how about we just get everyone together in one room? You know, let's get the vendor in, you, me, and my client. And I don't do that early on, but sometimes the vendor just needs to see that the purchaser is a reasonable person. They're not being difficult, really. Yes, they're standing firm on certain terms, but, you know, when it's explained face-to-face, sometimes it makes a lot of sense. But, you know, whether you're negotiating alone or as part of a team, sometimes you reach a point where you need to pause the negotiations, just simply to allow everyone to evaluate what they have achieved themselves so far. Now, it's important for you to note down the positives, make a realistic assessment of where you are and what ground you've covered, and that way you can accurately gauge your progress and then see whether your initial objectives ought to be perhaps reprioritised. Now, you'll find this exercise can engender renewed enthusiasm, and also it'll help to refocus attention and efforts towards your real objectives. But there's even one more interesting side benefit. You see, issues that have been defying resolution may now seem not as important as they might have been at the outset. And more often than not, the very same process will also be occurring on the other side. And as such, both of you will invariably resume the talks with a renewed focus on your main purpose and no longer be distracted by some of these earlier side issues.
I rather enjoy going behind the scenes with you, and I'm sure our listeners will have gained something from this as well. Perhaps we could pick up on this discussion and continue it sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, that's fine, Ken. I'd be more than happy to do that with you.